Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Jennifer Egan tells us about Michael Chabon's new novel, Telegraph Avenue.
I have always found Chabon to be a very sympathetic writer, kind of in the vein of Dickens. He treats his characters with tremendous humanity. We have a sense of what matters to them and that things do matter to them.
Parle Sagel discusses the remarkable flood of important fall fiction. Daniel Smith leads us into the strange world of high anxiety.
The social anxiety that an office environment fostered for me was just awful. Always wondering about whether my superiors thought poorly of me, whether I was going to make a mistake, whether I was coming off well, having to smile despite inner turmoil.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Michael Chabon is one of America's most inventive, accomplished, and hardworking novelists. He has a new book. It's called Telegraph Avenue, and it's reviewed on our cover by another major novelist, also like Chabon, a Pulitzer Prize winner, Jennifer Egan, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you.
All right, this is a really, really good novelist, and tell us what he's doing in Telegraph Avenue.
Well, as always, and I think this is the reason he's so good, he's doing many things. He's written, in a way, a kind of archaeology of a place, which is something I'm not sure I've seen him do before exactly, which is great, which is the Oakland-Berkeley area, which has a rich history reaching back, you know, even before the counterculture, which is, I think, when a lot of people became aware of it.
Right, the 1960s, where you have student protests on the one hand and Hell's Angels on the other.
Exactly.
And Black
the Black Panthers,
yeah,
which figure in this book. So he really does look through that archaeology, and that's evident on every page. The specific story that he tells is about a guy who's having a kind of midlife crisis or a growing up crisis. He's a nostalgic vendor of vinyl along with his best friend. He is Black, and his best friend and partner is white. And the two of them are have a business encroachment in the form of a former NFL star who's creating also African-American, creating a gigantic mall that's going to wipe them out. And then on a personal level, Archie, the protagonist, is dealing with a crisis of fatherhood. His first child is due. He's cheating on his wife. He's got an illegitimate son that he's never paid attention to who shows up. So there are crises on every level, professional, personal, and then all against the backdrop of this cultural collision, really, between the kind of Berkeley bourgeoisie and this longstanding African-American population of Oakland.
And Jenny, when you say vinyl, we're talking about records, right?
Exactly, yes. And there's a whole element of this book that is really about nostalgic collection. There's a card collector in the book as well, who's more of a minor character. But this kind of this nostalgic, not exactly anti-technological, but more a-technological, wistful interest in reconstructing artifacts from the past. And there are a number of characters who are interested in this. And it's very poignant. It feels very much of this technological moment in which it feels like we're really hurtling forward at such a pace that, you know, in a certain sense, we're all nostalgic just for 5 years ago, not to speak of 25 years ago.
Now, Jenny, when you describe all this, I mean, obviously, Chabon is a writer a tremendous imagination and a really fine intellect. It could seem really schematic, a series of ideas and conceits, but his fiction doesn't read like that, right? It has a kind of propulsive narrative force. The characters come alive. How does somebody do that?
I wish I knew. I think character is a big part of it. I mean, the people are sympathetic. I have always found Chabon to be a very sympathetic writer, kind of in the vein of Dickens. He treats his characters with tremendous humanity. We have a sense of what matters to them and that things do matter to them. And we become invested in their struggles. So that's a big part of it. I also think that sentence by sentence, he's probably the best fiction writer out there right now. I mean, he can pack a single sentence with so much humor, intelligence, surprising imagery, and just virtuosity. And so there's a payoff line by line in addition to the big payoff of the whole book and all that it's doing.
Jenny, another major American novelist, Richard Ford, when he did this podcast, told me he writes his novels sentence by sentence. Is this something that Chabon does? And is this something you do as well?
It's always hard to know how people write them. I mean, in a way, we have no choice but to write them sentence by sentence. I'm someone, I write blindly and very intuitively, so I would say actually probably not, in the sense that I'm not worrying about the words the first time. I'm looking for surprises in my own work that will be more interesting than anything I can think of.
Now, tell us what you mean by a surprise.
Well, I guess I mean that when I'm writing a first draft, which I do by hand to try to lull me into this more intuitive and less cerebral state.
The entire first draft by
yes,
hand.
Yes, the entire first draft on yellow legal pads. I'm looking to find myself writing something that I wouldn't have expected and that I couldn't have thought of consciously. Something that is not what I would be looking for. Those are always the best things, and I end up writing around those things. Those become the things that I orient the whole book toward. But I'm not really worrying about the words. Sometimes good stuff happens, but I don't care if it doesn't. I'm trying to get to those leaps and those surprises, the big moves of the book. I would be very curious to know how Chabon does it. I would believe it happens either way. I mean, there's such care on the level of imagery and sheer language that I would be tempted to say he writes sentence by sentence. But on the other hand, maybe that just happens intuitively, or it happens, you know, when he rewrites. It can happen any way. But in his case, it is sort of remarkable the number of times on a single page that he can amaze me with his language.
Now, he's written a number of novels, many of them well received. Where does Telegraph Avenue belong? Is this one of his important works?
I think it really is. I mean, I think my personal preference is for his books that have a kind of genre aspect to them. I absolutely loved his last one, too, the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is entirely different and yet has some similarities in that it's very informed by place, although in that case a slightly imaginary place of a Jewish state in Alaska, and also genre conventions, which he observes and subverts at the same time, which is so much fun. And he does all of that this time, but to such a different end that I think it's at exactly the same level. And I hand it to him for managing to do that again and again. I mean, that's what we all aspire to hit a high level again and again without repeating himself. That's the Holy Grail.
Jenny, something our listeners and readers always are curious to know about is how novelists read their contemporaries. Now, Chabon is someone you admire. Do you read each novel as it comes out, or have you read all his work? Do you just wait till the spirit moves? You hear a lot of good talk or buzz. I mean, in this case, we sent you The Galley. But how do you follow the work of your esteemed contemporaries?
You know, to some degree, I'm a little bit led by just what I feel like doing, which I think is ultimately determined by what I'm working on and what will feed it. So sometimes I fall out of step with work by contemporaries because it just isn't what I feel like reading, even though I know I should. And I try to honor that because I think the best time to read a book is when you really have an appetite for it, much like food. In the case of Chabon, I'm so interested in his work and have followed it from the beginning that I really have read most of his books just out of sheer desire and curiosity. Also, I feel like his use of language is so good and really so exciting that it actually is inspiring and invigorating to me. I feel like it's a true joy to read his prose. So I you know, right from the beginning with The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, which I read, I think, before I had even published a book, I've, you know, clearly seen that he was one of my contemporaries that was, you know, extremely talented. And I think that's why it's especially gratifying to see that he has absolutely, you know, continued to exploit and explore that talent and not sat back at all.
Is there ever a time when you say, I'm not going to read this novelist just now because what he or she does is so intoxicating or so close to what I might be trying to do that it will inhibit or infect your own work? Or some writers I know think that way, but you don't?
I would tend to probably go the other way and say, look, if what I'm doing is close to what someone else is doing, I'd better know what that is so that I can make sure it's not too close and understand the differences between us. So I would be inclined to go toward it if that were a concern. I think maybe the one exception is David Mitchell. As I was working on A Visit from the Goon Squad, I had a sense that it had some things in common with Cloud Atlas, which I had never read, and I didn't read it. So I guess that is what you're talking about. I just felt like it's too late for me to somehow change this to be less like Cloud Atlas if it is. So I'm just going to hope that our individuality will come through in these books.
And are there writers you go back and reread? Not necessarily contemporaries, but, you know, real lodestar novelists for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Edith Wharton is probably the number one.
Henry James.
Yes. Virginia Woolf. Dickens. I've been rereading a lot of Dickens lately. I feel like in that way I talked about with sort of what I have an appetite for from my own work, it seems to be 19th century fiction right now. So I've been in that realm, which in a way works well with reading someone like Chabon, who I also sense, I don't know him, but he seems to be informed also by that kind of big-spirited, wide range, you know, almost encyclopedic kind of generous storytelling.
Well, I have to ask you, your last novel won the Pulitzer Prize. It was a bestseller. Can we expect a new novel or some short stories from Jennifer Egan soon?
I don't know about soon. I'm actually trying to work on two books. We'll see how that goes. One is a historical novel set in New York in the 30s and 40s, and the other is sort of a sibling to Goon Squad, following some of those characters into other future and hopefully kind of structurally interesting realms.
Oh, boy, can't wait. Thanks so much, Jenny.
My pleasure.
That's Jennifer Egan, who reviews Telegraph Avenue by Michael Chabon on the cover of this week's book review. And now a conversation with my colleague Parle Sagel about a most remarkable development this fall, just the huge flood of books by major fiction writers. Parle, who are some of the really household name writers, major novelists who have books coming out in just the next few months?
Well, there's Michael Chabon has Telegraph Avenue. Juno Diaz has another book of short stories following his first one, Drown. This one is called This Is How You Lose Her. Zadie Smith has her first book, I think in about 7 years, called N.W., which is set in the neighborhood that White Teeth, her first book, was set in. There's Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, and J.K. Rowling has her first book for adults called Casual Vacancy.
And Tom Wolfe is a novel, too, that we haven't even seen yet, even though it's going to be published soon. Now, before you came to work with us at the New York Times Book Review, you were an editor for quite some time at Publishers Weekly, and then also at National Public Radio.
Yes, I was briefly books editor there.
In your experience, how often would you see this happen, this sort of collision of major names, major authors, and how do you negotiate that with the different audiences and readers that you're experienced with?
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this. And to think of it also in an election year, a fall that already there's so much happening, and to have this many novels coming out by this many sort of, as you said, like household names. I don't know, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see what sort of emerges at the top. Also, these are authors that have very, very different followings, I think.
Yeah, these are major figures who, you know, not to overemphasize the election theme that you've brought up, but in a way they have their constituencies, these writers. And you'll remember back in 2008, in another important election year, publishers were actually holding back fiction because they thought the election would overrun it. Do we have any idea why publishers seem less concerned about that now? Any guesses?
I haven't the foggiest, but I do think it's interesting that so many of the books that are coming out are political books or by writers who are fairly political writers. People like Zadie Smith, people like even Michael Chabon's new book is pretty political. And they're political and specifically interested in race. And specifically, I think, also in the case, Zadie Smith's book covers the financial meltdown. It's a big theme in her book. And Juno Diaz, of course, has written about being working class and a person of color in America very, very beautifully and well. And so, I mean, I think it's maybe that there's something in these books or something in this moment that also just dovetails with Obama's own story or...
Well, you know, you'll remember, Parle, after 9/11, we saw, not instantly, but over the course of a few years, ambitious major novels that tried to grapple with you know, that transformation or culture was, whether it was a novel like Claire Massoud's The Emperor's Children or Joseph O'Neill's Netherland. I mean, really gifted novelists, Don DeLillo's Falling Man. Right. We're looking at this change in the culture, trying to make sense of it. In some way, without getting political or partisan ourselves, are we looking at fiction that is in some way inflected by the Obama years and the Obama presidency?
I like to think so. But I also think that, especially with sort of, I guess, I don't know if you can call them this class of writers, we're also seeing books that represent their own maturation. And I think that they're also, just even in conversation with how they've changed, you have somebody like Zadie Smith for the first time really writing about motherhood. She's the writer who's grown up in public. You know, she had her first book out when she was, what, 27. You have Salman Rushdie sort of taking stock of his life in Joseph Anton. Michael Chabon as well. So yes, I think that they are in sort of conversation with Obama and with a certain kind of different dialogue about race, but I think that they're also really in conversation, at least to me as a fan, as a reader, in conversation with their earliest books and their own sort of trajectory.
And, Parul, you know many authors, many major authors. You've interviewed them. You've written about them. They tend to resist the idea that the work they're doing is overly influenced by the moment. Is that right? When we're talking about serious, ambitious writers, they're looking at literary history or they're looking at their own work. They're looking at what goes what they're thinking about, what their own preoccupations are. But you as an editor, as a critic, do you feel almost obligated to look at books in the context of the moment they're published in?
I can't help but do that. I think that all of us are looking for Rosetta Stones and explanations. And I think the best fiction writers, even if they're not doing as actually Zadie Smith does explicitly in NW, which is to grapple with what is going on now, I think that they're sort of steeped in the same anxieties that we are. They're steeped in the same sorts of workday pressures, family pressures, political pressures. Yeah, the best of them bring that to bear on their fiction.
Thanks so much, Parul.
Thank you.
Well, most of us, unless we're insane, feel anxious much of the time. There's a great new book called Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. It's by Daniel Smith. It's reviewed for us by Ben Greenman, who says it's a fleet, funny book and praises its tour de force writing. I'm delighted that Daniel Smith is here to talk about his book and his anxiety. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's not always funny. You had, like, a serious anxiety problem.
Yeah, still do. More or less. I mean, not as bad as a lot of the episodes that I recount in the book, but it's still a daily problem.
And when did it begin? When were you first aware of it?
I was first aware of it as a problem, not of the experience itself, but I first named it was first named for me, and I first understood it as a daily problem when I was 16 and lost my virginity in circumstances that I describe in the book, that most young men would probably be very happy to have happen, but for me, turned out to be feel pretty traumatic. I lost my virginity to two older women when I was 16.
Oh man, that could scar you for life.
I know, right? Well, this is the great shame of it. Now we're getting into the nitty gritty here. It didn't seem to me like it should be making me anxious, but it made me profoundly anxious. I mean, consumed by panic on a minute to minute basis, and I couldn't quite understand why.
And this haunted you. I mean, life itself became a kind of nightmare of anxiety, one anxiety to the next.
Yes. Before that, there had been anxieties. There had been phobias as a kid. There had been little tics. There had been little sensitivities. I'd been a very homesick little puppy when I was a kid. But it was after that point that it was really a horror, a waking nightmare of anxiety. And when my mother, who's a therapist and knows all about anxiety, use that word, I think, for the first time, and I started to understand it as a problem.
Okay, so this is one of the fascinating aspects of your memoir, is your mother. I mean, she knows all this stuff.
Yeah.
And is there any connection between her vocation and your problem?
There is in that she – it became her vocation because it was her problem too. Like a lot of therapists, I suspect she went into the business because she was so fascinated with her own problems. She had struggled with panic disorder, probably worse than I did, from the time she was a teenager into her 30s, maybe early 40s, and just struggled monstrously. And her therapist at some point suggested that she get involved in helping to treat people who suffered from panic disorder. Through that, she went back to grad school and became a psychotherapist who specializes in the anxiety disorders. So yes, that's the relationship. Whether her being a therapist and knowing about this caused me anxiety, I have no idea. I mean, I know it does now sometimes because like a lot of therapists, she likes to diagnose things and sees disorders in what I take to be maybe not normal, but regularly disturbed experiences.
Hey, the psychopathology of everyday life.
The psychopathology of everyday life.
Now, walk us through some of the instances, some of that kind of mundane, what would seem to be mundane moments when you really were stricken.
At that moment when I was 16, I could go down the hallway at school. I described this a little bit in the book.
And you grew up where?
On Long Island. Middle of the island, like very bland suburbia, mostly Jewish.
Which town?
Plainview. And I could walk down the hallways and assume because I had lost my virginity in this by on other people's lights glorious way that I was soon going to be dead of AIDS, that all the people around me were living glorious and happy lives and mine was now ruined because there had been a script in my head that I thought that my life should adhere to and it no longer would ever again. Everything would thereafter fall apart. And this is with no external stimuli making me anxious. This is all self-created and self-perpetuated. I mean, there's any number of situations. It's almost too – there are only almost too many to even think of one. I mean, I can
Well, something you describe it like having a sandwich.
Like having a sandwich, yeah. Like what do I put – I mean, that's one thing I describe in the book is what condiment do I put on a sandwich? Should I put on ketchup? Should I put on mayonnaise? Should I put on mustard? By a series of events, I could imagine the wrong decision leading me to complete and utter existential ruin. I have the wrong lunch. That makes me surly. That makes me nasty to my wife. That makes my wife want to leave me. That makes
you imagine all of this.
Oh yeah, very quickly.
Very quickly.
Very
right.
quickly,
right,
and right. And almost so quickly sometimes that I'm not connecting the steps. I mean, there's almost that I'm talking to myself in an almost pre-conscious way. It's so rapid, and next thing I know it, in my mind I'm in a ditch, drug addicted, and dying and alone.
Now something our reviewer Ben Greenman points out. In fact, when he uses that great phrase "tour de force," he's talking about the anxiety of writing, you know, writing, as I think Saul Bellow quoted Delmore Schwartz in Humboldt, one of the frantic professions. I mean, you would think, well, writing is a release for the anxious person, but in many ways it's not.
It's the worst thing for it.
Why?
Because anxiety is related to time. You're either looking forward to the things that are going to ruin you, or you're looking backward toward the mistakes that you have made that are going to ruin you in the future. When you're writing, you aspire to those moments where you're in the moment. But most of it involves trying to figure out what to put on a blank page, in other words, the future, or what to do about the mistakes that you've already made. In other words, revising
the
pages you've written that don't fit the ideal that you went into the work with, because nothing ever fits the ideal, or the blank page. Plus you are alone. You're stuck in your own head. It fosters solipsism, and solipsism is one of the things that defines anxiety. I think I went into writing not just because I love the English language and love literature and wanted to somehow join that priesthood, but because when I had my first job, I was working at The Atlantic right after college.
The great magazine.
The great magazine when they were still in Boston before they were cruelly and criminally brought to Washington, D.C., the social anxiety that an office environment fostered for me was just awful. Always wondering about whether my superiors thought poorly of me, whether I was going to make a mistake, whether I was coming off well, having to smile despite inner turmoil, I quit and told everyone that I was quitting in order to write. But I really quit because I couldn't stand being around people anymore. And becoming a writer is a great way to isolate yourself. But the more I think about it these days, the more I think that was a major factor in my decision to go off and be a writer. And that's all I've done, with the exception of some, you know, some freelance office jobs here and there and teaching recently, for the last 10, 12 years.
Do you find as a teacher that it was helpful for you, or remains helpful for you, to have this difficulty? Does it help you understand students? Do you get them better? Do they seem anxious to you?
Yeah, they do. They do. And they should be. But it helps and it hurts. It helps in terms of empathy. Anxiety is very good when you're not anxious, in increasing one's empathy. When you're in the middle of a period of anxiety or in some seizure of panic, empathy is very, very difficult because you are so deeply locked into yourself. I've described it as reminiscent of locked-in syndrome, as described in The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, the great memoir, in that you are in your head and it feels like you're sealed into your own mind. You can't see past it. You can't see anything past your own concerns. And when you're in a state like that, you can't worry about how someone else feels. It makes it very difficult to love. It makes it very difficult to be present for another human being. Then again, when you're not anxious, to know what that feels like makes it far easier, I think, to understand other people's suffering.
Now, Daniel, it could sound as if the condition you're describing, though of course intensified, is very much a modern one. But if we look back through history, your book comes with an endorsement from the great Oliver Sacks. Mm-hmm. You've done some investigation here. And what do we know about the role or the development or the changing nature of anxiety?
I've done some research, but I should say that going into the book, I tried to stop myself from reading much in the way of history, philosophy, or clinical information about anxiety, because I wanted to write a book that came at it from as strict an experiential perspective as ever, as I could. I was the expert because I'd lived the experience. Subsequent to that, I have done some looking into it, and I think we do live in a very anxious time. It's hard to deny that. But if you look at, for example, the 14th century, when the bubonic plague was spreading across Europe, when there were great religious upheavals, when an incorrect thought might lead you not towards thoughts of professional or marital catastrophe, but eternity in hell. And you weren't sure what the laws were because the religious authorities were changing the laws. When there were mercenaries going from town to town burning down villages. Now, that's a very anxious time, and there are some diaries from that time that show that people were actually obsessed with this experience. However, it hadn't been named. It hadn't been pathologized. That didn't really quite happen until Freud, until late 19th and early 20th century.
So prior to Freud, there was no, what, sort of clinical diagnosis of anxiety?
As far as I know, no, there was not. I mean, psychiatric diagnostics didn't really take off until the 19th century anyway. And then when Freud started to write about anxiety as a key to neurotic illness, as if we unlock the mystery of anxiety, we would unlock a great deal about the human mind. Subsequent to that, the various fields surrounding psychology, clinical psychology, neurology became quite obsessed with anxiety. Then the culture became obsessed with anxiety. Then Auden wrote The Age of Anxiety, an almost unreadable
It's an eclogue, yeah,
an
from
eclogue.
47. Yeah.
Yeah, and then a ballet was written based on it, and then a symphony, and Bernstein wrote. And then that phrase really came into currency. And you go on Amazon, there are a couple dozen books using the phrase The Age of Anxiety. In other words, I'm not convinced that anxiety increased, but awareness of anxiety increased. Writing about anxiety increased. Obsession with anxiety increased. Now, it might mean that because of the way anxiety works, because it's such a self-reflective experience and disorder, that simply by virtue of there being more writing and obsession in the culture with anxiety, that increases anxiety. Certainly more people are diagnosed than ever before. And certainly more people are medicated than ever before. An whole industry has been spawned spawned based on the explosion, so-called, in anxiety. Whether this means, though, that we're more anxious than people in the 14th century, I don't know. I'd rather, as someone who's predisposed to anxiety, I'm far happier living in the 21st century, even with all the ecological degradation and economic and international turmoil, and than I would be living in the 14th century. I like my penicillin. Thank you very much. And I like to know that if I get a cut, it's not going to lead to amputation or death. And that my wife can give birth to my daughter and I don't have to worry too much about them both dying. Now, this reduces anxiety, one would think.
Now, here you are, this great-looking, very well-spoken, and relaxed-seeming guy. Are you cured?
No, but I had a reader at some event I did accuse me of not being anxious. How could we believe you, he said. You seem so poised and so articulate. You can sit there and talk about anxiety. Now, aside from being medicated, there's the issue of performance itself for me being something, and talking as well, being something that reduces my anxiety, because it goes back to what I said about time. Sitting here talking to you with microphones on, I have no choice but to be in the moment. Now, prior to this, I was nervous. What if I screw up and say something stupid in front of Sam Tannenhaus on the radio? And after this, I will also go through a period of anxiety because I'll say to myself, what if what I said was not the right thing? I should have made this point. I should have said less or you know less.
And will you remember? I mean, is one feature of your anxiety that you'll be able to recapitulate or recall much of this conversation, or will it just be the same kind of bursts of remembrance most of us would have?
I have a terrible memory except for perceived mistakes that I've made. I am like an elephant for perceived mistakes. So I will remember every word that I think might have been unfelicitous, every sentence, and then by repeating them to myself in the elevator and over the course of the next 48 hours, they will be burned into my mind.
Well, when you listen to our podcast, once it's posted, you'll hear how great you sound.
I will not listen to it for fear of my head exploding.
Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks so much, Sam.
That's Daniel Smith, whose new book, Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's new on the lists, plural, this week?
On the fiction side of things, it's still the case that series novels just roll right along. All five new titles this week belong to series for the authors. Starting at number two with Louise Penny's latest Inspector Armand Gamache novel, The Beautiful Mystery. Then at number three, just below Louise Penny, is Tess Gerritsen. She's a Chinese-American medical and mystery writer, former doctor, with her latest novel is Last to Die. That's the latest novel in her Rizzoli and Isles series, which has been turned into a television show on TNT. Then at number four, Kathy Reich's Bones Are Forever, another series that's been turned into a show, the show Bones. Then down at number 10, Anne Perry has a new novel, A Sunless Sea, the latest in her William Monk series. Finally, down at number 13 on the fiction list is Christy Golden's Jaina Proudmoore, Tides of War, which is the latest entry in her World of Warcraft fantasy series.
Let's say you're out there and you're writing a series,
yeah,
and you're on like book 27, and it's never made the bestseller list. That kind of has to hurt, doesn't it?
It happens sometimes. I don't know if you'll remember last week, William Kent Kruger made the list for the first time ever with what I think was like the 12th or 13th title in this series that he's been writing for a long time, and he finally hit the list.
What's his name?
William Kent Kruger. He's a West Coast author, and he writes these regional novels.
So doesn't that mean there are like 7,000 series writers saying, Kruger made the list, and I didn't? All right, what have we got in nonfiction?
Just two new titles on the nonfiction side of things. They're both pretty morbid titles, actually. Literally, in the case of number 12, the name of the book is Mortality by Christopher Hitchens. It was just on our cover. And two spots below that at number 14 is the book Every Love Story is a Ghost Story by the journalist D.T. Max. That's a biography of the great novelist David Foster Wallace, who committed suicide in 2008.
It's interesting how those figures, Hitchens and Wallace, have enlarged somewhat.
Since their death. Well, it's interesting. Wallace himself did not make the bestseller list until he committed suicide, when suddenly Infinite Jest made the list for a few weeks. And then his posthumous novel, The Pale King, also hit the list for a few weeks. But this biography has hit the list right away, right out of the gate. And I think it's one of those cases where his death really engendered a lot of interest in his work. And people are just curious about him and his life. And there's a real cult of David Foster Wallace. And that's feeding into this, I think.
Greg, I noticed in the column this week, your column, you looked at Great Idea bestseller list in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. I did that partly because I was writing this list right after the Labor Day holiday. And so our own results didn't come in until late. And so I thought, well, what do I write about? And so I looked up at Canada, where they don't have Labor Day. And saw.
Is that because nobody works up there in their perpetual welfare state?
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the things I write about in the column is that on there are a lot of overlapping titles between the American lists and the Canadian lists. The newspaper I looked at was the Globe and Mail out of Toronto. It's kind of a national newspaper.
Yeah, great newspaper.
Yeah. On the fiction side of things, it was just what you see here: Danielle Steele, Gillian Flynn, Emily Giffen, all three E.L. James titles, the 50 Shades titles, lead their list. On the nonfiction side, there was some overlap too, but there were more specifically Canadian titles. Michael Bryant, the former Attorney General of Ontario, has a book called 28 Seconds, talking about a death where somebody ran into his car and he was investigated for drunk driving. Michael Bryant was, and he's kind of writing a defense of himself there. So that's specifically a Canadian title. But there's overlap. Again, Cheryl Strayed with her memoir Wild leads their hardcover nonfiction list. But one thing missing from their list that you see on ours is all the anti-Obama books that are coming out ahead of our election. And you'd expect that in Canada, but
you'd expect them not to be on the list.
Exactly right. It's the whole Tip O'Neill politics is local thing. Why would they be reading anti-Obama books? It is interesting, though. I went back, and Obama's own memoir, Dreams from My Father, was a Canadian bestseller in 2005.
No, there you go. I guess that was a book that had an international following. I wouldn't be surprised if other countries too, particularly in the period when Obama was emerging as
right.
this very
he had
new
this celebrity kind of status that really transcended politics at the time.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.